We am here after a brief delay, joined as always by the incredible Russian Sam.
Salutations. Sorry I've been absent.
Yeah, no worries. It's been a chaotic few weeks for a lot of us, which is why for this episode, we are going to talk about one of the most chaotic weeks, I would argue, in American history. It was an incident that captured the attention of people across the country in 1910, but one that's little known today. This incident we're talking about was the climax of the labor struggle in Los Angeles from the turn of the century. We all know Hollywood as the land of glitz and glamour, but 113 years ago, that hadn't quite taken form yet. Instead, Los Angeles was a battleground. A battleground where the terms of the ensuing century were being forged. The battle was between labor and capital in one of the most naked class conflicts, I would say, in American history. And the really important thing that we're going to chart in this two-part series is that this was a battle which labor lost, which had enormous ramifications on basically the ensuing history of California history and American history more broadly.
Yeah, this episode we're going to be covering took place in the prehistory of California politics, in the years leading up to the first Red Scare of 1919. Los Angeles was just barely emerging out of its origins as a dusty frontier town, as we talked about previously in the Hail Caesar episode. The film studios had not yet arrived, and the tallest building on the skyline was just 12 stories. The state's vast wealth was still mostly untapped, and the manufacturing base was just starting to come together. In 1910, LA was far from becoming America's second city. It was the 17th, but it was growing at a rapid pace.
Right, because trains were bringing in newcomers every day from places like Kansas, Iowa, Louisiana. The Panama Canal was about to open, which would soon make transcontinental travel incredibly easier. Also, on the other side of the pond, the first commercial airlines had just begun service. All this meant that America was shrinking. The geographic barriers that had once limited demographic expansion out west were no longer there. People were moving, people were settling, and California was full of unoccupied fertile land.
And just how that land became unoccupied is certainly something we're going to have to come back to in a future episode.
Absolutely. But in this point, in 1910, everybody knew that California was the future. What kind of future this would be hadn't yet been decided. All right, so at the time of this story, LA was still, as we said, a pretty small town, but it already had an established power structure, and interestingly, a pretty new one. There was something that historian Mike Davis describes as its downtown business clique, and this is a clique not in the high school lunch table sense, but more of in the violent 1920s Chinese sense, because these were a very close-knit group of ruthless industrialists, all of them white from Protestant backgrounds, who controlled the press, the city government, and the Chamber of Commerce. I'm not sure if any city in America in 1910 had a ruling class as tight-knit, as exclusionary, and as ruthless as Los Angeles, which of course is very different from how you might imagine LA today. Although these guys were very rich, none of them were old money. They were almost entirely newcomers from other parts of the country, like we said, often the Midwest, Ohio in particular, and they had recently and pretty successfully pushed out the older and actually somewhat more diverse and more less respectable business elite. If you look at the list of LA city councilmen in the 19th century, you find a lot of people with Mexican names, others immigrants with Irish names. You'll see a lot of Jewish people, also a lot of Basques, interestingly. I feel like those guys are always coming up in this podcast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Someone mentioned that Gladio for Europe pilled them about the secret Basque hands that are pulling at history.
Yes. No, the Basques are everywhere. Yeah. But unfortunately for the Basques, by 1910, people like that from, you know, immigrant Catholic backgrounds were being sidelined because the Midwesterners were coming in such large numbers that they could define Los Angeles on their own terms. Of these Midwesterners, none of them loomed larger than the person of Harrison Gray Otis, later known as General Otis.
Like so many other transplants from across California's history, Otis came from Ohio. He was born into a family that was once connected to the important New England Puritans, but who by now led a hardscrabble frontier life in the 1830s. Although he grew up in an isolated log cabin, his elderly grandfather had fought in the American Revolution. This seems to have instilled in the young Harrison a lust for adventure, as well as a belief that he too was destined for greatness. At the age of 14, he became a printer's apprentice, briefly flirting with early union membership, but this was before he had raised enough money to attend school for writing and rhetoric. When he was 19, he eloped with one of his former teachers, despite the protest of his family.
Yeah, kind of a baller move, I gotta say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big Macron moment. So Otis and his wife, Lizzie, began traveling from town to town across the Midwest. They got newspaper work wherever they could. When he was 24, the Civil War had broken out, and Otis immediately enlisted in the Union cause. He survived the brutal Battle of Antietam and became a newspaper editor and Republican Party official. Like so many other Midwesterners in the later 19th century, he moved out west, where he'd launch his most successful media venture, the Los Angeles Times. When Otis was in his 60s, he convinced his old ally and fellow Ohioan William McKinley, who had been his superior officer during the war, to allow him to lead a volunteer battalion into the Philippines in the Spanish-American War. This earned him the title of General Otis, which he wore broadly for the rest of his life.
Yeah, we're sourcing much of this episode from the book Deadly Times, written by Lee Irwin, published 2013, I believe. He has a pretty interesting description of what General Otis was doing. Although he never actually directly saw combat against the Spanish, he was certainly in some danger. Writing here, he set out onto the battlefield, armed with both pen and sword. One of his staff officers would later recall noticing the general during a skirmish, sitting on his horse, writing a dispatch to the Times, seeming to be searching for the nicety that his superb literary workmanship demanded. A Filipino battery spotted Otis and his men, and every few seconds a shell exploded near them, splattering them with mud. But still, the general wrote. Finally, the staff officer spurred his horse to the general's. Had he noticed that the shells were coming close? Yes, yes, Otis replied, perturbed that his word search had been interrupted. I noticed them. And then he continued composing his dispatch.
Yeah, I gotta say, very hard man, to be honest. You have to give him that, at least.
Yeah, no, certainly, yeah. He also had a very important ally, which I think their specific relationship shows how close-knit this ruling circle was. Because this ally was both the general manager of his paper at the LA Times, and also his son-in-law. This was a man who would have a very important role in California politics, really throughout the early 20th century, named Harry Chandler.
Yeah, Chandler, no relation to LA writer Raymond Chandler, was a New England college boy who had dived into a freezing cold tub of laundry water on the dare. This incident nearly resulted in his death of hypothermia, and his doctors recommended that for his health, he should drop out of school and head to a warmer climate. So he got on a train to California and got a job at the LA Times, loading huge stacks of newspapers onto delivery trucks, which were owned by independent delivery companies. With the money he earned at this job, he started hiring paperboys to begin his own delivery company. By the time he was just 23, his operation became the primary delivery service in LA, and he started investing in real estate, which across the next 10 years would give him a huge fortune.
Right, and just to jump in here, real estate was everything at this time. It kind of still is in California. But, you know, we're talking about how California, it's known for the fact that there's, like, so many natural resources. There's the climate means you can grow so many plants here. For a while, there's gold, you know, there's so much oil in California. But really, real estate is where the money is, bringing in more people to buy and to sell. Harry Chandler, real self-starter, he recognized this early. And the fact that he bought so much land so early meant that by the time he was like 30, he was one of the wealthiest people in town.
He began to buy shares in the company that employed him, the LA Times, and he eventually became the most important friend and ally of his boss, General Otis. When he was 34, Harry Chandler married Otis's daughter Emma, in the process forming essentially a medieval marriage alliance between two of the most powerful capitalists in Los Angeles.
Right, and so both these guys, Harry Chandler and Harry Otis, were staunch fiscal conservatives and opponents of immigration, policies were becoming increasingly dominant in the Republican Party. Before we talk about Otis's specific worldview, something you pointed out, Russian Sam, that I thought was really interesting, is the fact that Otis's trajectory and the fact that he's from Ohio is actually emblematic of a pretty important and pretty widespread shift in the Republican Party in the late 1900s, or 1800s.
Yeah, absolutely. As the Republicans became more and more entrenched and the last holdouts of radical Republicanism fell to the wayside during the debacle that was Reconstruction, Ohio just became sort of the nexus point of the new kind of American ideology, which we can still see to this day in some regards.
Absolutely. And so Otis, very repellent guy. You guys are going to find out what's so bad about him. But I think that if you look at his trajectory, his turn toward the right wing makes a lot of sense in some ways. Because number one, like his son-in-law, he was this very independent guy, a real self-starter. So obviously he probably had a distrust of taxation, a distrust of unions. He wanted to be this, you know, naked capitalist without anything, any fetters holding him down. He wanted to exploit people as much as he wanted. Interestingly, though, he had previously been an abolitionist in the earlier 19th century. So it kind of seems like that wouldn't jibe together. But in the context of the 19th century, I think it makes a lot of sense, especially considering he probably was basically negatively polarized against the more progressive labor policies of the Democrats. Because if you're a Republican in the 1860s, once the issue of slavery is done, you still see the Democrats, you know, the party who had been the party of the South, as the party of the traitors. But interestingly, in the 19th century, and really, I guess, basically straight to the present, the Democrats were also the party of Northern labor, a labor movement which was heavily made up of Catholic immigrants. So you can kind of see how these various biases intersect here. If you're somebody who might have been somewhat progressive in the 1850s, opposing slavery, by the 1870s, you're really just opposing the Democrats. And you might pay less attention to the Southern, formerly slave-owning Democrats, and more attention to all the Irish Catholic Democrats, who you see as restricting your ability of free enterprise, and who are helping put the Southern traitors back into power.
Well, yeah, because there was, at this point, no real fundamental class antagonism between these people. And so, given this constellation of facts, it's not really surprising that that Otis himself was very xenophobic and very against immigration. Although, as we'll see a bit later, the labor movement itself was full of these tendencies, because that's just
unfortunately
late 19th, early 20th century America for you. But to continue, in Otis's worldview, quote, employers of labor should be ready to meet and vanquish those who make unreasonable and arrogant demands upon them. Thanks to the great coordination and cohesion of its ruling family, this kind of vanquishing seemed possible. Business leaders and the early LAPD worked to repress labor organization across Los Angeles in an effort to make the city a conservative playground. It was kind of like the Colorado Springs of the times, a place where hard-right Republicans could test out policies not feasible in other cities. And the most famous of these was the so-called open shop.
Right. So the open shop, it's a policy which is illegal now, thanks to the New Deal. But what this is a situation in which employees of a company, or in this case, a city, are forbidden to organize a labor union. This is thankfully unthinkable today. It was not so in the late 19th century. And basically, as soon as General Otis got to California, he began pursuing this kind of policy as pretty much his life stream.
Yeah, it's also important to talk about San Francisco here for a little bit, because San Francisco was just the opposite. It was the nest of the labor movement in California at that point. They had a closed shop system across the city. The labor movement was very powerful politically, and it made it well known, which really scared the shit out of people like Otis, because they thought that this system would inevitably make its way to Los Angeles unless it were beaten down with a heavy hand.
Absolutely. I think it's kind of ironic today, because these days, you know, a lot of people might see San Francisco as kind of the home of like the techno-libertarians, whereas Los Angeles is surprisingly well unionized. It's kind of funny how these things change. But let's talk about what Lee Irwin says here, because he sums it up pretty well. He writes, as part of a strategy to counteract the encroachment of unions in Southern California, Otis had co-founded the Merchants and Manufacturing Association in 1886, essentially a chamber of commerce, which was the same year he took over the LA Times. He assembled into its membership all of those business leaders in Los Angeles who saw themselves as threatened by the advance of organized labor. Its motto was, "We will hire no union man." They installed a guy named Felix Zaylander, a former reporter, as the president, and blacklisted any businesses that had signed contracts with unionized workers. It's crazy stuff. According to an unwritten policy of the Chamber of Commerce, open shop businesses would only do business with other companies that refused to hire unionized workers. And also, we should mention here, by this point, all of their members were Republicans, because by the later 19th century, you are starting to see more of a kind of class antagonism associated with the two parties, especially as the progressive movement, which was generally amenable to labor, became strongly aligned with the Democrats.
And there was one other very big push by early 20th century California conservatives. This was, of course, eugenics.
Yeah.
Harry Chandler was a member of the so-called Human Betterment Foundation, an explicitly white supremacist group which was based out of Pasadena, which pushed for the sterilization of supposedly inferior peoples. Its founders were Chandler's close friend E.S. Gosney and USC president Rufus von Kleinschmidt. While Gosney and von Kleinschmidt appear to have mostly focused on the sterilization of mentally ill people, which is obviously still very reprehensible, other members targeted those they believed to be racially inferior.
Yeah.
The most notorious of these men was the Cal State Sacramento founder, Charles Gatty, who wrote that the Mexican and Italian immigrants were the greatest threat to the California gene pool, because while African-American and Asian-Americans were banned from marrying whites, intermarriage between native-born Americans and Catholic immigrants was commonplace among the working classes.
Yeah, yeah, and one thing, we talked about prejudice against Italians in the Columbus Day episode, but reading this kind of made me realize that there really was a lot more prejudice against people now considered white than you might expect back then. And this was like as late as like the early 20th century. It's kind of interesting. Like this is like, these days Italian Americans are completely assimilated into whiteness, but they were very much still targets at this point. And I do think that part of it is that
anti-papism was just a major current in American life all the way from the beginning until basically the 60s when Kennedy was finally elected.
Right, right. And another issue here that is the fact that immigrants, especially Italians, but not exclusively, were associated with organized labor and labor radicalism in particular. A fair amount of anarchists in America did have an Italian background, but this was used, number one, it was generalized to all anarchists, who many of them did not, and of course it was also, used to justify prejudice against any Italians, regardless of political beliefs. So there was this idea that certain parts of the country, like Chicago, like New York, like Boston, had been taken over by immigrants, most of them Catholic, and had also been taken over by organized labor. These guys, the 100% WASP group running California, especially Southern California, didn't want that to happen. They, if anything, saw California as kind of like the last hope of this libertarian white utopia. They were incredibly explicit about their racial vision in a way that no conservative would be today. But I think there is still echoes of this in modern conservative politics. The idea of this supposed racial purity paired with these libertarian economic policies, because that was seen as the kind of natural outcome for Anglo-Saxon people or whatever, as opposed to the organized labor policies of the immigrants.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, all right. But going back to the eugenicists, although some of them were much less explicitly racist than Gatty, they were all fundamentally part of the white supremacist movement. Their activities promoting sterilization in California would be a model for people of similar inclinations worldwide.
Yeah.
In 1934, when Gosney and Gatty were both old men, Gatty wrote this letter to a longtime comrade in eugenics. Quote, "You will be interested to know that your work has played a powerful part in shaping the opinions of a group of intellectuals who are behind Hitler in this epoch-making program. Everywhere I sense that their opinions have been tremendously stimulated by American thought, and particularly by the work of the Human Betterment Foundation. I want you, my dear friend, to carry out this thought with you for the rest of your life, that you have really jolted into action a great government of 60 million people."
Yeah. So you can see here like the consequences of what these guys were doing.
Yeah, like there, I would say there is a tendency to overemphasize the degree to which the Americans influenced Nazi racial thinking and policy with regard to eugenics. And although I think at this point it's a little overblown, there is definitely a lot of American fingerprints all over this rotten muffin.
Right. The mistake people make, which I don't think is intentional, is suggesting that American racialism wasn't just an influence on German Nazism, but was a key ingredient. Because ultimately, this just exculpates centuries of homegrown German nationalist reaction. But they were reading what these guys were saying, and they were agreeing with it. Mike Davis, the other historian who we're drawing on heavily, who I hope many of our listeners are familiar with, because he's just, He described this vision by the eugenicists, as well as other, you know, right-wing industrialists, so we're saying Harry Otis and Harry Chandler, as the vision of California as the promised land of a millenarian Anglo-Saxon racial odyssey. There was this imagined shared racial and economic mission that these guys were trying to accomplish, to establish a society run exclusively by white Protestant men, in which there was no limit to the ability of the capitalist to dominate industry. Any participation of people outside that Anglo-Saxon umbrella would only be as low-paid immigrants. They, you know, they would be like the serfs on the Latifunda, while the guys from Ohio, you know, sip mint juleps. And that's why, again, it's like, it's crazy that this was like a lot of former abolitionists pushing this. You know, it's like, I don't know, it just kind of shows like corruption comes to everyone.
Yeah, well, I mean, just because you don't believe in slavery doesn't mean that you don't hold other reprehensible views is really right. The main lesson.
Yeah,
here.
Absolutely.
And the overwhelming majority of abolitionists were not the radical Republicans. They were not Thaddeus Stevens.
Right. According to Davis, the downtown clique wrote the script for the giant real estate speculations of the early 20th century and transformed Los Angeles from a small town to a metropolis. Their imagery, motifs, values, and legends were in turn endlessly reproduced by Hollywood, while continuing to be incorporated into the ersatz landscape of suburban LA. And so these guys, with dirty tricks and often outright violence, ousted the previous magnates of Los Angeles, you know, the guys who were more likely to be Mexican or Jewish or Irish, and began building their own twisted dream of this free market Aryan enclave, which would be so different from the crowded and immigrant-heavy cities of Chicago and New York. Although these guys had a firm grip on levers of power in LA, they couldn't really control the hearts and minds of the people, especially because they expected some immigrants to still come over, you know, as cheap labor. Because while many Angelenos supported Otis and Chandler's notion about race and class, others, like, are obviously were targets of these notions. So out of necessity and self-preservation, the dispossessed of LA would violently resist the vision these guys were drawing up for the future of Los Angeles. They'd accomplished this most directly in 1910, by striking at the rotten heart of the Otis dynasty. So let's see who the guys were that did that.
All right, so American labor history is vast, and unfortunately I haven't had the time to really dig into the nitty-gritty at this point. So for now, we're just going to focus on one particular branch of the labor movement, and that was the International Association of Bridge, Structural, Ornamental, and Reinforcing Iron Workers, or simply the Iron Workers, because that's quite a mouthful. This was an affiliate of the AFL, which remained under the leadership of Samuel Gompers for the remainder of his life. Gompers was really the doyen of the reform-minded American labor movement, the so-called bread-and-butter unionism that we hear a lot of really nasty things about, with good reason.
Yeah, so basically, because the point of bread-and-butter unionism is the idea that American workers should only argue for safer conditions and better wages. They should not attempt to recreate society in any kind of radical vision, which is what the more radical workers' movements of many European countries were doing at this time. So kind of in a sense, you know, I think Gompers did have a fundamentally good intentions for American workers, but he had a very limited views of, number one, who American workers were, and number two, what exactly they should accomplish.
Speaking about this particular affiliate, the Iron Workers were founded in 1896 to represent steel building, which was a profession which was originally centered around bridge building. But as the skyscrapers began to crop up all over major urban skylines across the country, they expanded into the skyscraping business as well. They were regarded as unskilled labor originally and were looked down upon by both their employers and their peers because the latter thought that they were so much better than they were. Hashtag labor aristocracy.
Right. And, you know, this was dangerous work. These are the guys that you've seen in the famous photo, like eating lunch in a steel beam. And these were dangerous men, accordingly. They were known as the most militant profession in the entire labor movement. And had good reasons for that. They had very miserable working conditions, and there was a constant risk of death by falling. It seems like as the buildings got higher, their work, therefore, got more dangerous. But there was little remuneration to show for it. So because of that, in 1906, they organized the largest coordinated plan by organized labor to sabotage the capitalist who had scorned them. With the expertise of just a handful of men, the workers targeted the enemies of the labor movement to explosive effect.
And we're going to look at the men who stood at the center of this right now. The first person on our list is a man named Ordy McManigo.
Right. So born into a poor Irish-American family in, you guessed it, Ohio, he was orphaned at the age of 12, at which point he began quarrying stone in 1886. Quarrying, pretty hard work, no matter doing it. But one new invention in the later 19th century made it a lot more doable, especially for a child. It's also something that you think a child should never be handling, because this invention is dynamite. He spent a full decade of his life in the stone quarry, dodging falling rocks and shielding his eyes from the splinters of stone created by every single demolition. By the time he was 22, he'd saved up enough and taken enough from this life to move on to the city, where he began working as an iron worker in the new skyscrapers of Chicago and Detroit. Eventually, he joined the Iron Workers Union, probably not realizing he was joining one of the most radical labor organizations in the country. We should mention here that part of why they were so radical is because, in an effort to avoid paying union rate wages, construction companies would often ship in rural workers who didn't know about the union to do non-union scab labor.
Yeah, the union went about a few different ways of solving this. They had sort of a honey and vinegar approach, or maybe it would be more appropriate to call it a salt and vinegar approach, because the nicer way to do it was for a union man to go undercover in a non-union job site and to begin salting, as they called it, convincing co-workers to join with the union. The less pleasant method was to call up a group of guys known as the Entertaining Committee, which was basically the union's own goon squad who would show up at the site and rough up scabs. And this is where the union's affiliation with mafia type organizations really began.
Yeah. And so if roughing them up wasn't enough, the Entertaining Committee had one more option to send a message to the capitalists and to the scabs. This was sabotage. They would do things like unscrew rivets off a bridge to make it collapse overnight, or even use dynamite to blow up construction sites the day before they were set to open. So these guys would, so therefore the industrialists would spend so much money on building a site, but then they get nothing out of it. The hope was that this would financially disincentivize capitalists from using scab labor. In a sense, it was protection money. Here, pay us a living wage and your lovely new bridges aren't going anywhere.
Right, so from 1906 to 1910, there were roughly 200 attacks on non-union construction sites. Interestingly, none of these attacks were all that deadly, with one exception, which we're going to spend a lot of this time in this episode talking about. But these union men were nevertheless castigated by the press as terrorists and anarchists, and they began to adopt these labels themselves. Eventually, they realized that the most effective way to destroy a non-union construction site was with dynamite. And that's why when Ordy McManigo signed up for the Iron Workers Union, a union officer named Herbert Hawken was sure to take notice of his past life in explosive rock mining. According to Irwin, McManigo was initially resistant to become involved in any kind of bombing and sabotage because he was just not really an ideological guy. He just really wanted to earn his day's bread. But when Hawkins threatened to have him blacklisted from all union sites, he folded. And within a week, McManigo had successfully dynamited a non-union construction site in Detroit, in exchange being paid $75, worth over $2,000 in 2023 money. Soon after this, Hawkins sent him on a mission to destroy a non-union railroad site in Illinois, and the checks just kept on coming.
Right. And there were a few close calls. At one point, McManigo detonated a bomb without knowing that there were three night watchmen in the vicinity. Apparently, later, he felt incredibly guilty about this. He had no intention of putting people's lives in danger, which, of course, would kind of foreshadow his later guilt further on, as we'll get to. So after this incident, when he almost killed three men, he told Hawken he wanted to quit. And Hawken said, oh, sure, you're welcome to do so. But, of course, as soon as you quit, we're turning you in. Because, you know, therefore, they could say, oh, this guy, he was acting alone. Us, the rest of the union, were clean. In other words, McManigo was locked in. Just like being in the mafia, this is not a job you can quit if you want to stay out of prison. Instead, McManigo stayed on as a central player in this bombing campaign.
Yeah, he worked alongside the so-called McNamara brothers, who were generally just known as JJ and JB, and they had a very similar profile to McManigo. Once again, they were Irish Americans from Ohio.
So JJ was a full-time office worker employed by the Iron Workers Union at their headquarters in Indianapolis. Which is funny, you know, you don't really think of Indianapolis as like a city of labor radicalism or anything, but in the early 20th century, it very much was. In 1906, he was approached by Herb Hawken, just like McManacle was, to take part in this secretive bombing campaign of Strzok construction companies. Hawken asked JJ if he could hire somebody to discreetly buy explosives. And JJ had an idea. He'd get his younger brother, kind of a fail brother, confusingly named JB.
Right, because where the older JJ was a charming, well-spoken man with an intellectual flair, he had put himself through law school, ultimately. The younger JB was a regular ne'er-do-well. He was a chain-smoking regular at the Cincinnati saloons, and he had a real bad habit of getting fired from his jobs and having affairs with married women. Now, it seemed that the first job that he ever really took to was as the explosive assistant to Ordy McManigal. The two of them began working together as partners in the bombing campaign, but as the paychecks started to come in, McManigal began to realize that he was earning less than his assistant, because it turned out that Hawken had been skimming off of McManigal's paycheck for years at this point. When this was revealed, JB approached his brother, JJ, who then spoke to the union leadership and tried to have Hawken fired. But the leaders knew that they couldn't just fire Hawken, because by this point, he just knew too much. He would immediately inform on their activities if he should be kicked out like that. But little did they know, Hawken had already been informing on the union for years at this point.
Right. You know, like any great story, there's a Judas. And Herb Hawken, one of the worst ones around. He was one of those guys who everybody in the union knew, but nobody knew much about. You know, if you read about a lot of radical parties, you often find somebody like this. Someone who's always hanging around, who is trusted by the leadership, but there might be a few details that don't totally add up. He was an exceptionally repellent character, it turns out, because about a decade before all of this, he'd been accused of molesting 16 different children in Detroit. He was almost certainly guilty. One of the victims picked him out of a police lineup, but then he was suddenly acquitted when an anonymous letter writer claimed he, in fact, was the real perpetrator, not Hawken. So I gotta think, it must have been a pretty easy to beat a case in 1900.
Yeah, absolutely. This guy, he was just a maniac.
God, yeah. And so after dodging these charges, Hawken, who reporters described as having a pleasant and convincing manner, as well as a manner of mystery about him, managed to reinvent a new life for himself as a union iron worker and began rapidly rising up the ranks of the leadership. But this entire time, he had a second gig as a paid spy of the construction consortium. He'd been hired to infiltrate the iron workers union from within, collect information for a future prosecution that would be intended to destroy the union and really discredit all organized labor as radical and unreasonable. And next episode, we're going to see what this great trial looked like. But at this point, nobody knew Hawken's true purpose. They foolishly trusted him. This is why you gotta do background checks. They thought that he was, at worst, a corrupt and unreliable bureaucrat. So this meant that he was pulled away from an upcoming job, but was still a part of the organization, still learning incredibly important information. McManigal and McNamara would work without him to pull off their most ambitious heists yet, because the Iron Workers Guild was now turning its eye westward to the ongoing labor battle in California.
Yeah. All right. So it's now 1910, and J.B. McNamara first visited the San Francisco labor leader named Olof Tveitmo, who was originally from Norway. And on the West Coast, many of the labor radicals were immigrants of Scandinavian or Jewish backgrounds. One of Tveitmo's allies was the famous anarchist Emma Goldman, herself from Russia, as well as the renowned lawyer named Clarence Darrow. You might have heard of this guy because of his greater activity defending the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial. But at this point in time, Darrow was best known as a member of the Midwest populist movement and a legal ally of labor leaders such as Samuel Gompers and the Industrial Workers of the World leader, Big Bill Haywood. This was a really fascinating guy. His most famous quote was, "I never read Marx's Capital, but I have the marks of capital all over my body." And
right, yeah. By contrast, Darrow was not an express socialist, but a lot of his friends absolutely were, like you mentioned Emma Goldman. There were also two men in San Francisco who are very important to this story. These were David Kaplan and Matthew Schmidt, nicknamed Schmitty, who were explicit anarchists. And we should mention, you know, that in the period before the Russian Revolution, anarchism was a pretty lively movement, much more so than now. Before 1917, I don't think it was clear that Marxism would become the dominant movement of, you know, the socialist left. These guys gave it a real good shot.
Mm-hmm. But getting back to our story, So in June 1910, shortly before McNamara arrived in California, a consortium of San Francisco employers announced that they would not renew any employment contracts with the union unless the unions accepted salaries as low as the non-union Los Angeles. This was, for all intents and purposes, a declaration of war, and the labor movement responded in kind. While the above board leaders of the ironworkers organized a strike, the anarchists Kaplan and Schmidt began drawing up plans for a statewide bombing campaign, directly targeting the reactionary industrialist General Otis and Harry Chandler for their incessant propaganda against the union cause.
Right, because you mentioned these guys have been opposing any form of unionization in LA, and they were seen as the source of this new push in San Francisco. Otis was also a pretty unpopular figure, you know, and not just among the unionists, because he was a very eccentric guy in a way that won him few friends. His fervency about the open shop movement made other businessmen uncomfortable, but what really creeped him out was his bizarre military affectation. He was 73 now, and his wife Lizzie had just passed, and it seems like that once he became a widower, he kind of went off the deep end, because he devoted his entire life to his anti-union crusade, penning his own right-wing columns in the LA Times, spending all day in the LA Times headquarters, which was a squat granite building nicknamed the Fortress. And according to Irwin, it wasn't just called that because of its size and shape.
By the end of the decade, Otis began to appear obsessed with all things military, wearing his metal-bedecked uniform to the Times office more regularly and keeping a stand of 50 Springfield rifles installed, quote, at the ready in the Fortress. Another case of sawed-off shotguns was kept next to the managing editor's desk in the third-floor editorial room. He had an ornamental cannon mounted on the hood of his brand-new six-cylinder air-cooled Franklin, and rifles and swords hung from the ceilings of the second-floor hallway of the bivouac, the bivouac being Otis's mansion. Again, very very big on all the military stuff in his personal life as well.
Yeah.
continuing from Irwin, Many thought the martial displays to be signs of senility. Others saw them as evidence of an old man's growing resolve for a decisive confrontation with the unionists.
Right. So this means that even people who might have been opposed to the union and were certainly terrified of anarchist bombing were pretty uncomfortable with this guy. Fellow Republicans went so far as describing him publicly as having a gangrene heart and a rotten brain, grimacing with every reform, going down to his grave in snarling infamy. So in other words, General Otis was a deeply hated figure in Los Angeles. His son-in-law, Harry Chandler, was much better with ingratiating himself with other people, but not a lot of people shed tears when Otis's property would be struck. This means also that he was the most obvious target for this anarchist campaign purely on an emotional level, because he's like the Monopoly man, right? He's this icon of capitalist avarice, as well as militarism, imperialism. He's got ties to eugenics, just an all-around very repellent guy who people who might have been already predisposed to support labor saw as essentially the devil incarnate.
Yeah, just a little bit outside of a respectable opinion. Just that one weird uncle,
right,
who shows up at your Thanksgiving party talking about the nanobots, that kind of
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, right. And so therefore the union recognized they could strike a blow against everything rancid about American capitalism. And the best way they could do this would be by blasting to bits his beloved fortress.
And so on September 30th, 1910, Otis and Chandler would publish a political cartoon which showed a devious anarchist about to pick the pocket of an innocent worker who grabs his wrists and says, "No more." What Otis and Chandler didn't realize is that this would be the last issue of the LA Times their presses would churn out. Because earlier that month, the anarchists Kaplan and Schmidt had linked up with J.B. McNamara. The Ohioan had initially not gotten along with the pair of Californians. Perhaps he was scared of their more radical worldview. But Schmidt won him over, ultimately, by spending a raucous weekend cavorting with liquor and prostitutes. He might have also won over Schmidt's notorious girlfriend, Belle Levine, who was a real-life femme fatale, who 2 years prior had publicly stepped out on her husband, who then killed the guy and himself in a brutal murder-suicide.
Right, yes. Again, it's pretty a lot of colorful characters here. Schmidt and McNamara have this kind of lost weekend kind of thing, partying across San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they're done, they had spent the equivalent in modern dollars of like thousands of dollars on booze and women. But it wasn't for nothing, because the two guys had become...
Yeah, they spent like $125 on taxis alone.
Yeah, which would be thousands today. It's insane. It's hard to imagine. But they spent a ton of money just partying, and it was not for nothing, because these two guys, these basically two terrorists, had become great friends, and they had now figured out a plan to destroy the LA Times building. They'd plant bombs not only in the fortress, but also in Otis's mansion, the Bivouac, as well as the home of Felix Zehandler. That's the guy we mentioned who was heading the Chamber of Commerce. These bombs were all set to go off at 1 o'clock a.m., when presumably the building would be empty, and so there'd be no people who could potentially be hit in the bombing. During all of this, David Kaplan was traveling across San Francisco getting pieces to build his bomb, based on instructions given by Mickey Manigal. He used the very unassuming pseudonym William Morris to do so, which turned out to be kind of a surprising mistake. So he was somebody with very dark features. He was Jewish, but often mistaken for an Italian. And this mattered because when he went to buy one piece of the bomb, a salesman asked for his name. He said, William Morris. And then according to Lee Irwin, this candorously racist salesman says, Morris, that's a good American name. You're obviously a Dago. He still sold the guy the stuff to make the bomb, but he remembered him, which would ultimately be a very big problem.
Yeah, and Schmidt also didn't help in that regard because he had a glass eye. He had lost his eye previously, and everyone who met him was really put off by him because it seemed like he was cross-eyed. His glass eye just never moved. It really creeped people out, and this was one of the major pieces of identifying evidence used at the trial, ultimately. I mean, so this plot would be the largest and potentially most dangerous bombing campaign of the Iron Workers. McManigal and his operations had been very careful to ensure that there were no bystanders or night watchmen who would be close by. In fact, Irvin even recounts an anecdote where at one point he set a bomb and he realized that it was right by the guard post. So he basically tried to invite this guy over to the opera for the night and so he wouldn't be there when the bomb went off. But the guard remained steadfast, and so instead McManigal had a brilliant idea where he would change the timer of the bomb that was further away from the post to detonate a few minutes before the other one would, which would presumably cause the watchman to get out of his post and check in to see what the ruckus is all about, at which point the second bomb would explode. And that's precisely what happened.
Clearly a very meticulous guy, which kind of makes it all the more tragic that he would ultimately, you know, to get ahead of ourselves a little bit, basically be implicated in a mass murder.
Right, so on the 30th of September, the day that the LA Times would print its final cartoon, J.B. McNamara walked into the fortress. There were no security guards or doormen, so he could walk straight into the printing room. When one worker noticed him and asked what he was doing, J.B. shouted over the roar of the machines that he was looking for a job as a printer. They told him that there was no work and that he had to go home, which he promptly did, but JB had gotten everything that he needed. He had a great look at the inner layout of the Los Angeles Times building, and so he went back to his hotel room, where he began assembling the bomb made in the same manner as those of Ordy McManigal. These were the so-called Inferno machines, which struck over 150 targets all across America. He placed one such bomb in the rosebush outside the Chamber of Commerce leader Felix Zaylander's house, and then he made his way over to Otis's mansion around 10 blocks away, hiding the second bomb in the shade underneath the windowsill. And then he walked towards the LA Times building. He knew that there was no way to avoid being seen, so rather than to stop by once work had ended for the day, JB slipped into a crowd of newspaper printers and placed the bomb in an alley by the building, right behind the printing floor.
Right. And this is where the story gets messier and where it kind of moves over from fact to speculation and hearsay. Because after he did that, he made the strange choice, according to eyewitnesses, of not making a clean getaway by exiting the alley and going back onto the street, but instead going back into the building. He could have just left, but he didn't. And so Lou Irwin speculates, based on the assumptions made by McManigal in a much later trial that would pit essentially these two bomb makers against each other, he makes a pretty bold claim, which was that McNamara went back into the building because he chose to do something extreme. He went downstairs into the basement, where he found the building's boiler, which used gas to heat the building. and wrenched open the pipes to fill the building with natural gas. It was incredibly inflammable. Therefore, the explosion would be far grander than the Iron Workers Union had anticipated, sending a much deadlier message than McManigal might have wanted. As soon as he may or may not have done this, McNamara gets on an overnight train to San Francisco to reunite with Kaplan and Schmidt, knowing that by the time he arrived, the LA Times would be no more. What he didn't know, however, was that this was a very special night for the paper, because news was about to come out of the winner of the Vanderbilt Cup, the first American auto race, which is beginning at 4 a.m. in New York. A few young journalists, therefore, were still working late into the night in the print shop, receiving telegrams about the progress to get the score out for the morning edition. Therefore, at 1:07 a.m. on October 1st, just as these guys were following the progress of these drivers out in New York for the race, somebody heard a ticking sound come from behind the wall. And just as they began to investigate, the wall was blasted to bits. Across the street, people were woken by the sound of the explosion. Windows were blown out all across the area. People feared it might be an earthquake, just like the one that had destroyed San Francisco 4 days earlier. But instead, this was a deliberate attack.
And then the gas ignited. This immediately engulfed the already ruined building in flames. The fire would then spread across the entire block. As the flames reached the upper floor, witnesses saw some workers climbing to the roof and then jump off to their death. Most of the workers managed to escape, but 19 people died and many more were very seriously wounded. In the chaos of the explosion and fire, two men who had escaped were wrongfully declared dead. But nevertheless, it had been the most deadly terrorist attack in American history. And it would hold that honor until another group of anarchists set a bomb off in Wall Street a decade later. But the other two bombs, which were planted in the homes of Otis and Zaylander, would not go off. Which was too bad for J.B. McNamara, because the one that did made him the most wanted man in the world, and the other two were a breadcrumb trail that led straight to him.
Immediately, this attack was condemned by labor leaders like Samuel Gompers. Others, like Clarence Darrow, insisted it was a false flag by the crazed General Otis in an attempt to defame labor. Olaf Tvitmo, the man who had introduced Kaplan and Schmidt to McNamara, offered a $7,500 reward to anybody who knew who perpetuated the bombing. And even J.J. McNamara described the bombing, which he knew was done by his brother, as anarchy, pure and simple. No sane organization would resort to anything of the kind under any circumstances. I do not believe that labor unions had anything to do with it.
General Otis would not be seen in public for many hours after, and some people thought that he himself had succumbed. But the true reason that he wasn't present is that he was actually out of town. He was in Mexico in an official capacity to attend the centennial celebration of Mexico's independence at that point. Yeah, but as soon as he heard the news, he rushed back to Los Angeles and the general began to command his battalions into battle. And so just 8 hours after the bombing, the LA City Council appropriated an emergency fund of $25,000 for Mayor George Alexander, who was a right-wing Scottish immigrant, to apprehend whoever had done this. That same day, the Chamber of Commerce donated $50,000 to the city.
Yeah, and the LAPD, which actually, interestingly, just hired the first policewoman in the U.S. named Alice Wells, they began combing the streets for suspects, and I can guess they probably targeted immigrant neighborhoods most heavily, which was a mistake because the guy had already skipped town. That evening, Otis returned to Los Angeles. He was met by the police chief, Alexander Galloway, who offered him a security detail. But Otis, in his, you know, classic, you know, bravado, thought that would make him look weak. Instead, he was convinced that God was on his side and would protect him from any harm, explaining to the chief that, "I believe there is still a God in Israel." Otis then went to the site of the bombing, still smoking. The frame of his building, the fortress, was still standing. And in one of the all-time best PR coups for the American right, he had installed a bronze eagle at the top of the building, and that bronze eagle had not been destroyed. An emergency new issue of the LA Times was immediately ordered to be printed. I believe this was donated by a rival newspaper in a show of goodwill. And this time, in this emergency edition, it would bear a poem.
High on the ruins of the battlement, the eagle stood unscathed above the wreck of dynamite and death.
Right. The second page, though, was less sophisticated, because Otis had penned a hastily written column simply entitled, must blame unions.
J.B. McNamara read the news coverage in the San Francisco papers that afternoon and then visited Olof Tveitmo. But Tveitmo refused to see him, demanding that he never make contact with him again. Because by failing to detonate the other two bombs, incredibly valuable evidence had fallen into the hands of the LAPD. He tried to see Schmidt, but Schmidt was dealing with his own problems. His girlfriend Belle had apparently just left him over his involvement in the deadly attack. And so, JB had nothing to do but to head back east to Indianapolis, home of the ironworkers where his brother JJ worked. And by all accounts, he was really shaken in the aftermath of this attack, as we're going to get into the next episode. He was just a total mess. He couldn't deal with the fact of what he had done. But
right, because he killed about 20 people, and I think most likely he didn't intend to. There's a lot of question about whether or not he deliberately screwed open the gas valves. I think in any case, even if he did, I don't think he expected people to be covering an auto race late at night. I think he thought it would be empty.
But meanwhile, in the LA City Hall, it was clear that the LAPD had found no plausible suspects. All they had were two unexploded bombs. Mayor Alexander decided he needed outside assistance. Somebody who could trace the explosive back to its source. He summoned to his office the first man he could think of, the private investigator William Burns.
Right, and he's one of the most fun characters in this whole thing, because Burns had no formal training as a detective. Instead, he was a failed actor. He realized, though, he could make a name for himself in other means. He initially started volunteering his assistant to the New York police, and after years of bothering them, they started bringing him on as an unpaid assistant, basically, helping them solve crimes. Apparently, he wasn't too bad at it, and he used his tiny grain of notoriety to do something pretty devious. He started writing articles and short stories about himself under assumed names, and sending these stories to pulp magazines all across the English-speaking world. So audiences from LA to London were learning about this guy named William Burns, the world's greatest detective, and this actually worked in turning him into a celebrity, giving him bigger and bigger cases, allowing him to accumulate more authentic notoriety. He eventually became this kind of real-life Sherlock Holmes, and we have to mention, this was right at the height of that character's popularity. You know, it might not be a coincidence. And as a consequence of this, in 1901, when President William McKinley was killed by Leon Czolgosz, William Burns insinuated himself into that whole crisis and promised to help find Czolgosz. More importantly, though, just 2 months before the LA Times bombing, he was investigating another bombing, also where a bomb failed to go off, in Illinois. He managed to grab the explosive device from the site and was able to trace back the various components that made it up to shops in Illinois and Indiana. He met with sales clerks who described the man who had bought these pieces. He didn't know his name, but he knew his age, his build, his appearance. So when William Burns arrived in Los Angeles, he already had a man in mind, especially when the LAPD brought him the two bombs found at the homes of General Otis and Zoolander. The three devices were identical, surely made by the same man from Illinois. They didn't know this yet, but it was already McManigal. Eventually, they would trace these pieces of the bombs to a small shop in San Francisco, where a xenophobic shop clerk would remember a surprisingly swarthy man calling himself William Morris, who bought the equipment.
Burns knew that the same man had made all of these bombs, even if he couldn't name him. But Mayor Alexander would make it worth his while. He promised to give the entirety of the emergency fund to Burns as a reward, plus an additional $25,000 if he could apprehend the man. All in all, Burns received the incredible payout of $100,000. That's over $3 million in today's money, for anyone who's keeping count.
Yeah, so William Burns, you know, always the glory hound, and likely always, you know, looking for a paycheck, couldn't say no. And thus began the most publicized manhunt in American history, which would eventually lead to one of the most publicized trials in American history, in which the famous lawyer Clarence Darrow would take the stage defending all the guys we're talking about. Wardy McManigal, J.B. McNamara, J.J. McNamara. We'd learn about the treachery of Herb Hocken. Really crazy stuff. And we're going to get into all of this next time. I'm glad you're free.
All right. Well, thank you so much for providing the idea for this episode, Liam. I honestly hadn't really heard about this before, aside from maybe tangentially. It seems like the LA Times isn't really trying to associate itself with these events these days.
No, yeah, I can see why they wouldn't, especially when you realize how repellent so many of the people on the side of Capitol were back then, right? Like, you know, because you start talking about why these guys blew up the building, then you got to get into, you know, the open shop stuff, the eugenics. Yeah, it's just a very nasty time. You know, we're sourcing all this from Lee Irwin's book, as well as a little bit from Mike Davis. Irwin is very much not sympathetic to the bombers. He explicitly describes this as a story without any heroes, in which even the famous Clarence Darrow doesn't come off perfectly. But I think this kind of reminds us that this was just an incredibly militant time when both labor and capital were pursuing their agenda with kind of a determination that allowed them no sentimentality, to take no prisoners.
Yeah, and of course, we mentioned the Entertainment Committee a bit earlier, but just so we're clear on this before the episode is over, like, the capitalists were very much in the same game. They were also hiring their own roughs to beat people up and kill them in some other circumstances. I mean, this entire period was just a period of violence that really wouldn't be eclipsed at any point in American history until maybe the Civil Rights era, honestly.
Yeah, it was absolutely just
full of rapacious people, and the workers were fighting back with the means that they could. Just
right.
To quote from the Battle of Algiers, you give us your fighter planes and you can have our baskets. This is basically the name of the game. And unfortunately, a lot of innocent people did die in this one particular bombing. We should stress that this was very much an aberration in the labor movement's terrorism of the era.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and again, it's, you know, there's the kind of famous Mark Twain quote about how the French Revolution involved two reigns of terror, the one during the revolution and the one that lasted for centuries before it. And we have to keep that in mind with talking about this context. Like, 25 years before this bombing, you had the infamous Haymarket massacre by the Pinkertons. And then just a year after the bombing, there'd be the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. This was before the emergence of the eight-hour week, before unionism was fully legal in every city. I think it's certainly very regrettable that this happened. These people should not have died. They should have tried much more strongly to prevent this violence, but I don't think I can disagree with their motivations. I think that even if this is not a particularly romantic struggle, this is a struggle in which one side is certainly far more sympathetic, and it's not General Otis with his cannon on his Model T.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. Well, all that next episode, as well as the brief, brilliant rise of the Socialist Party in America, and how they came pretty close to taking over the mayor's office in LA. So we'll see you guys soon.
Bye-bye.